fact checker features interview. I want to apologize to our audience and apologize to our fantastic guest, the guy that's directed 35 amazing films, and you should go buy them. Don't VOD them. Go buy them. Yuri Boll, I want to apologize for our first interview that accidentally got deleted by me. Nobody else's fault but my own, and I'm very sorry, so I'm apologizing to my audience and you now that it was me that doing it. But let's get into the thing. This idiot Alex Jones, who says stupid things on the internet, doesn't want to have a boxing match with you. Tell me why. Let's punch this guy out.
I think he is a pussy. And I think he, besides, like, talking very loud and very outspoken, he is about, like, the most absurd things on the planet Earth. I think he's all talk, you know, no action. And a lot of people I met in the last 10, 15 years are basically like this. They are, like, this kind of, like, coming across, like, the tough guys. But overall, they're all, like, whiny. And feeling bad for themselves the whole day. And then they're lashing out merciless against other people. And for me, the thing with Alex Jones, what really topped it, was when he denied that school massacres, Colorado, Littleton, and others, were fake, made by actors to damage the NRA, is absurd. I mean, it's like if you're parents from a kid who got actually shot in one of the massacres and somebody runs around and says it's all fake, they're all actors, nobody, that massacres actually never happened. If I'm the father of a kid like this, I would go find him and punch him out, right? So, I mean, I would not ask him to do a fight in the ring. I would just go wherever I find him and smash him into a pulp. And so I felt he called out like Alec Baldwin and other people to fight him because he's so strong. And I said, okay, let's do it. I fight you, Jones. You know, so I'm old. I have to be back in boxing training for it and everything. But I'm happily doing this. And I'm happily going in the ring even with my hip arthritis, so every step hurts. But I think I would fight for the good fight, for the good thing there, against a proven asshole and a proven liar. So I hope, like, people listen to your podcast, they start Twittering about it, they Instagram it, you know, like important is that everybody who's listening to us right now puts that message out there, because everybody has other friends on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and so everybody gets a different audience to listen to it and to hopefully duplicate that message. So,
do you think Alex Jones is ducking you? I mean, because he's a chicken, I guess, or just pretends you don't exist?
Yeah, he's a chicken, and he makes advertising for this. Hormones, right? So he takes, like, male hormones, like drops or whatever. I think he sells the product. It's like like the people in the Wild West who sold, like, whiskey as a medicine. And I think the whiskey was actually better as that what he sells. But so he's posing in the internet too with, like, his muscles and that drops helped him to build more muscles and to lose fat. And whatsoever. I think it's of course fraud, but at the same time, if he's all muscles, I mean, why he doesn't want to fight me? He's younger, he's heavier as me, so where's the problem? So he should just do it and say, well, I pummel you into the ground, I kill you, I'm right, you're wrong, whatever, like, so he should answer. Even his ex-wife is calling him out for it. And I think, there's no real explanation. You know, I mean, if I would be Mike Tyson calling him out, I agree why he should answer. But he maybe can defeat me. He maybe can win the fight. And that is the thing always, like, when I boxed the critics in Vancouver years ago, I felt like I trained very hard. So I thought that maybe one of the critics is a better boxer and puts up a real fight, but they couldn't. So, but did I know this? No, I don't. I never saw these people in my life before they traveled to Vancouver to fight me, and I agreed to fight four people in a row, and I did it. So, and it's the same. So I'm not, like, scared. I go for it's like my responsibility then to be as fit as I can be in the ring and do my best to win. So, and that is what sport is all about. So that is why I see him really like chickening out, like he's really like hiding and not responding to any kind of calling out so far.
What was your training be like?
No, because of my hip, I'm not able to do long jogging runs anymore. So I go on my bike, and then I do kind of a weight training. And then what I have to basically add is punching the bag again, you know, and then going in sparrings, like doing actually fight preparation, fighting against other people in sparring fights. And here in Vancouver are some good boxing gyms where I did that before I boxed the critics, so I would go back to them and fight the normal fighters they have there. And it was interesting because I'm skilled in Germany 14 years, and Germany at that point was very much trained by Eastern German communist bloc coaches. So what you got there was very good cardio. So you got very good, very fit, basically. And one of our coaches was the coach who coached the Klitschko later. But Stunek, so he was one of our coaches. And guys like this, they have a lot of, like, Olympic experience on the world level. So they, when I boxed them here, when I went in Vancouver to training, I saw that, like, my background is way better as the background from the boxers here. And, like, being able to just technically throw a better punch, basically, right? So but I was older already and trained here against, like, I was 40, and then I boxed against the 25 years old kid, so they were physically stronger as me. But I think so. I got a good background in boxing, and normally I'm able to also, like, if I feel somebody is stronger, I'm able to kind of get out of his way, like getting in a way that I don't get pummeled, right? So you have like tricks how you can basically interrupt the fight and don't let a guy totally smash you into a pulp with the background, and that made me feel kind of safe going in the ring again, right? So feeling like you have some stuff in your repertoire what other people don't know. Don't have.
Have you ever been knocked out in a boxing ring?
No, I won all my fights. So I won 17 fights. I never lost. But that was also, I think it came together with the training. I was physically very strong, very good cardio, so I could really march forward. But at the same time, I'm careful. So, and a lot of boxers, when you begin, like the first 5, 6, 7, 8 fights you do, they are just want to rumble. And they totally lose it on you, basically. But then they're running out of an energy within 2 minutes, 3 minutes. They're getting tired already. And I was always, I could box 10 rounds, even if it was amateurish, it was only 3 rounds. So I was physically fit enough. I know if I survive the first storm here, I will get better and better into the fight and actually can hurt the other people. And that is actually what basically almost happened in every fight I did. I didn't look good the first bit, and then I normally got really, really better in round 2 and round 3 and won the fight. But, I like boxing when we did our chat an hour ago. I said it also helped to make me less aggressive, and you get a little more this kind of strategy and plan, and but you also are more careful, you know like bare knuckle fighting, you will bleed, like you break your hand, whatever, like, I mean, it's not if you hit somebody with your hand without a glove in the face, you maybe broke your hand. At the same time, you break the nose of the guy, so it doesn't really appeal to be a good idea to fight in general. And I really had, like, after I went to boxing, I think I had one not real fight, but it was a short interaction in a bar 8 years later. But the rest, I never had any fight, street fight, fighting people at all after this.
What do you think of boxing films? Like Rocky, maybe Gentleman Jim?
Yeah, Gentleman Jim's funny. I love Rocky 1, you know, because of the heart, what was in it. It was really also like Sylvester Stallone fighting for his life in a way, fighting for his career. And I loved Rocky Balboa, you know, the last, in a way, like the his farewell movie. And then Creed was good too. I mean, because I think Stallone is a very good director also. I like a lot of things what he did. I mean, he played a lot of shit movies too, but yeah, he's kind of a character, and I always liked Stallone as a type. And he has also this kind of heart, right? You feel he has a big heart, and Rocky One was one of my favorite movies of all time. I really love it, and I love Raging Bull. I love The Boxer with Daniel Day-Lewis. That was a good one too. Was it The Boxer? Was it the name The Boxer, or was it a different name? But he played the boxer and really went to sparring and everything. Typical Daniel Day-Lewis. He went then all in, and. But I think also there were like some take Southpaw, right? So I think it's an overrated movie. I think it's not really realistic. I think it's not a bad movie, but it's also this kind of like when you see the boxing, the same with the Mark Wahlberg one with Christian Bale, the Fighter, what was it again? Where he played
the Daniel Day-Lewis movie is called The Boxer. I checked for you.
Yeah, and then the one with Mark Wahlberg, where Christian Bale got the Oscar for. What was this again?
The Fighter, isn't that The Fighter?
Yeah. And then you know what the problem? My problem with that film was that Mark Wahlberg cannot box. No, it's just horrible, right? Christian Bale, who plays only a little like his coach in a way, you see right away that he is more able to throw just a jab as Mark Wahlberg. Wahlberg is kind of a bodybuilder. Who basically is doing a swing? He cannot do a straight jab, like throw a jab as a starter. Like if you cannot throw a real jab, you can never be a boxer. And he couldn't. And that was the thing where I felt like this kind of I was a little let down by the boxing. You know, I mean, amazing movie is Million Dollar Baby.
Great film.
Yeah, one of the best Clint Eastwood films of all time. And that very, very gritty, because it turns into that other thing when she's paralyzed from away from boxing to can you end your life on your own terms? And it was a great movie. And Hilary Swank was really good in it. And also there you saw what box training can make out of an actress. She really went into it, and she really pulled it off. You know, and Raging, to be honest, like Raging Bull is a masterpiece because of the transformation of De Niro into Jake LaMotta. But the boxing is so over the top, it's more like an opera.
Yep.
Yeah, you know, it's not real. It's so over the top and bloody and absurd. A little like what you have then in Rocky 2, Rocky 3, Rocky 4, where the fight's getting so absurd, where you would be dead, but you're still standing. I mean, that is the problem with some of the Rocky boxing fights. But Raging Bull is basically an excellent biography, like a movie about somebody who really existed. And I think it was great. And I was very surprised that I think last year Jake LaMotta died, right?
He did.
I mean, I knew that guy was existing. I thought he's dead like 20 years ago he died or something. But he turned over 90 before he died.
Okay, let's go into your other project. You've done some great posters for Rampage, and Warner Brothers has obviously ripped you off. I mean, we've seen that. I've seen that on Twitter. I've seen that in other things. But if you did that, you'd be vilified.
I know, I said, like, first it happened with the Phantom Thread poster that what looked exactly like my Blood Red poster. And I felt if that would happen the other way around, that Paul Thomas Anderson did Blood Rain and I did Phantom Thread, then, and I would rip off his poster, everybody would give me shit for it. Everyone would say, oh, of course Paul is ripping off the poster because he has no ideas on his own, right? So, but because it's the other way around, it's like, shut up, Paul. It doesn't matter. And then a few weeks later, Warner Brothers comes with a movie Rampage named after, they say, the old video game. But in a way, the last 9 years, my Rampage trilogy was existing and everywhere, from Netflix to HBO and everywhere. So, and of course, on DVD, Blockbuster, etc. And so I felt like, okay, it's enough. You know, I mean, I retired because there's no money in the business anymore for independent filmmakers. You basically have no DVD business anymore. And Netflix and co, they're giving like Brad Pitt $50 million to make a movie, but they don't give me any money to make a movie. They say to me, shoot a movie, we buy it for $50,000. You know, and you say, yeah, but how should I get the rest of the money back?
Like, exactly.
From heaven or what? I mean, like, it's like, oh, sir. You know, so and that is the thing. It's like, it's a rigged system there. And and I felt, okay, now they are already making enough money and now they're even copying old ideas from independent people and don't pay for it. They don't say, okay, you know what? We want to use your font or your poster idea. Here's $5,000. You know, whatever. Like, but no, of course not. We don't pay for anything. So we have enough money to pay to that multi-million-dollar contract. It's one other thing also what we didn't mention in our first round of the taping, what we didn't tape, but sometimes the second one is better as the first one. But is this kind of what I felt in the last, when you read about, and this is how I started loving cinema, is reading about directors, reading about actors, and so on. And I felt like it's all about the money today. You know, and it's like in the early years, also people didn't get so super rich. You know, like icons like Marilyn Monroe, she wasn't really rich when she died. You know, they had like $1 million maybe, or was something. You know, not like now every idiot makes like $150 million in 3 years being on a TV show. You know, if you do Friends or Will and Grace or whatever, they're getting like $1 million per episode. Whatever, it's like crazy. So people, basically, if you're a really successful actor right now, if you have one good year, you never have to work again. And that is the fact, right? And in earlier years, people, they got like, whatever, I read when I read about the John Ford, like he basically developed John Wayne, right? So, and John Wayne was a superstar. And he got like $50,000 or $80,000 per film, not more. You know, I mean, it added up because he made like 150 movies, but on the other hand, and of course at that point, 80,000 would be now like $1 million. But still, you have like one of the biggest movie stars of all times, and he maybe made $20 million in his whole career, based on today's level, right? So, we have that, all that franchises and all that stuff, where people working 2 months and getting like the Jennifer Lawrence, whatever, $20 million and all that stuff. I mean, I think it divides them also away from the normal population. And then they're sitting in the talk shows with Jimmy Kimmel and all that people. But all these people make also $25 million a year. You know, how they, and then they're all acting like they have a deep interest in like what's happening on the planet or what's happening to the middle class. But it's only acting. You know, they go to Me Too movements, they go to like, they're acting like they're street fighters, and but in reality, they all go back to their guarded communities and have like 15 people working in their house. You know, like my gardener meets my massage therapist and my private hairdresser. I mean, that is the world they're living in. And I think it's so fake, and I think the money is one big issue where you feel this kind of the rich getting richer and richer, and then they have their little Hollywood base, what they feed with money, so that they, you know, like that it looks like they're supporting them, or you know, like it's always good if George Clooney is on your side if you want to be president, you know. So I mean, it's ridiculous. I think it went away from any kind of okay level to being completely overpaid, and also spaced away from the results. When you see whatever Lionsgate reports a loss, but then like Feldheim as a CEO gets $38 million a year. I mean, you know, like if you have a company and you make a loss, then you should make no money. I mean, that is the reality, right? So, but all of that is over, and it moved in a totally different dimension now, that people just getting money no matter what, and other people have a hard time to pay the monthly bills.
Earlier we were discussing video games, and we discussed how you based a lot of your properties on video games. And you just said you enjoyed making them. So that gave you a lot of different genres to go down.
Yes. I mean, with the video games, House of the Dead was the first one. And I love zombie movies. I love Dawn of the Dead from George R. Romero. And I wanted to give the zombie genre a little more faster zombies thing with weapons, like a little more skilled. And at the same time, felt if I make a video game-based movie, let's get some animation footage in. I got grilled for it. I got very bad reviews for putting animation footage in. But at the same time, now a lot of movies doing it, and they don't get criticized for it. So I was kind of a front runner on it. And at that point where I started it, there were not a lot of video game-based movies around at all. And you had like Wing Commander, you had like Street Fighter. But you didn't have a lot of video game-based movies made. And so I started kind of a trend after me from Resident Evil to whatever, a lot of different projects came out. And the new Rampage movie is based on the old video game as an example. And I tried when I acquired the video games to get different genres. Alone in the Dark, like a more like a creature sci-fi thing, and then you have the epic adventure with In the Name of the King, and you have action with Far Cry, a comedy with Postal, Blood Rain, I started Blood Rain. I think it's an interesting trilogy with Blood Rain too. So because we always moved 100 years forward, so we had like the vampire time with real like Romania, Blood Dracul, 1700, and then we moved into the Wild West, and then we moved into the Second World War with Blood Rain, and with In the Name of the King 2 and 3, we did time travel. We did a different thing. Also, we didn't try to copy Part 1. What if you see another like Resident Evil? I think it's basically always exactly the same, and it's boring. So, and I felt to do different genres is a good idea to as a director too, to be like, my style is basically always like being behind the story. Like, so I try to present the story in the possible way that it makes sense. That it's, if it's a movie with a lot of sci-fi, with a lot of CGI, you do a little more from the dolly, more controlled with the crane, stuff like this, Steadicam. If it's more like a reality movie, like Darfur, about the genocide in Darfur, or Rampage, or South of Wall Street, you do more handheld. You do more doku style, so that you feel as the... as the viewer, you're in the middle of it. You're in the middle of the mayhem, and in the middle of the action, and you basically look reality. And I feel that it's more important for me to present the story appropriate to the what you want to say, as to say, I need to create the Uwe Boll trademark and do stuff whatever 5 minutes you watch from any of my movies, you feel you are in Uwe Boll world. You know, so like a Tarantino world, or, you know, I never felt I have to do this. I put the story first.
one thing I think a lot of people don't know about you, you fund yourself, you do everything yourself. You know, and I think a lot of filmmakers need to do that. I mean, you have a lot of control over your films. You can do what you want. I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, but the price you pay for it is a lot of responsibilities, you know, a lot of stress, and a lot of things where you don't have, like, this kind of shield what a lot of other people have. With agents, managers, PR companies. So it's all me directly talking to the viewer, talking to the distributors, talking to, you know, selling my movies on my own, financing on my own, making them on my own. Yes, you are your own boss, but that comes with a lot of responsibility. A lot of people, they're angry if they don't make the money back and stuff like this. So I had to go through this for like 20, 25 years, and that was not easy. A lot of people maybe would broke on it, like they would like break apart and couldn't do it. For me, it was more like, I want to make movies since I'm 10, since I watched The Mutiny of the Bounty with Marlon Brando. So for me, I wanted to fill my dream, whatever it costs. And I felt like if I have to pay that price to make it happen, I pay it. And I fulfill my dream, basically, right? So, and of course, you get disillusionized on the way. You see, movie making is not like being in the Caribbean on a pirate ship and living there, right? It's more like, of course, you fake reality. But at the same time, you also, in a way, have a very, like, adventurous life. And, for example, I'm not the biggest travel fan. In general, it's not like, oh, I love to be 2 months there and 2 months there and 2 months there. I was never, I'm more like home-based, basically, yeah? So, but I'm happy that I had to do all the travel, because I shot 2 movies in South Africa, 2 movies in Croatia, a movie in Bulgaria, a movie in Romania, various movies in Germany, various movies in Canada. And I think it's important, because when you are longer, when you make a movie, you're longer somewhere, you're not only on holiday for a week, you really see what's going on in that country. And you get a good impression, like, where stands Romania now, and where, you know, and not only, like, what food you get there, but also, like, what is going on there. In Bulgaria, the same. And I'm happy that the movies brought me in contact to a lot of different countries, people, and made me think different about a lot of things. So, and I think it's very, very important when you see today's time and on the politics of today's time that, I mean, Trump makes everything out of his ass, basically. Whatever his daily politics comes from what he's watching in the morning TV at Fox, Fox and Friends. If they would never talk about Syria again, he would completely forget that. But I think enormous important for is like you should, whatever it is, you should not make decisions on anything or any country without talking to people who live there, who existed there, who are on the ground, right? So because it's so much different to watch whatever satellite cam or to just read newspapers or TV shows, or you actually get some feedback of people living there. And it could be like agents you have there, but it could be also like just normal citizens from that country telling you what actually happened. You know, and I think that really matters. And when you live somewhere a little longer, I think you know way better what to expect and what not. For example, when we shot In the Name of the King, that was number 3 in Bulgaria with Dominic Purcell, we had a guy from Pakistan who was our CGI guy, basically. And, it's poor network connection. Should I put the TV off?
No,
video off?
You're good. You're totally good. You're fine on my end.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah. And so the guy from Pakistan, he told me, like, and that was when Osama bin Laden was just killed, basically, like, shortly before. And he said, like, in Pakistan, a lot of people, including him, knew that Osama bin Laden was living in that compound, like for years. So the question is like, how could then nobody know? Like, I mean, like, how is that not leaking out or whatever, right? And I think that is the result if you don't have people on the ground everywhere, like locals, not like agents, right, where everybody sees, okay, that guy's a CIA agent, I see from 5 kilometers away. You need natives working for you everywhere, because then you get like very valuable information very early on. And the same is like if you would have, before everybody accused Saddam Hussein to have like weapons of mass destruction, if you would have more people living in Iraq or Iraqis reporting. You're totally frozen. I will not hang up.
Okay, good. Keep going. I just saved it with five. Continue.
Yeah. So, no, but then about this. So, the travel with all the movies, I think that was a very beneficial thing. It was very good to do. And it was also, like, for example, South Africa. What I really learned, I mean, we know in South Africa, was Mandela came back, and then he ruled, and then the other guy came, Zuma, who is corrupt, whatever. But the overall person in South Africa is way happier as us. They just, overall, you know, you have good weather, you know, like this kind of like, it infiltrated even all the black people we met and worked for us on the movies and everything. They were like, they know they went through racism and all of this, but overall, they were happy. And they were happy about the small things, right? Some barbecue you do or whatever. So, and that made me also feel kind of, I'm a spoiled, arrogant Western brat, basically, you know, who is so used to a lot of things, and they are happy to with way less, and they still like feeling good about themselves, you know, and we feel sorry about ourselves 24/7, including myself, right? So like the thing, it's like it makes you a little more thinking about where you stand. And that we should not take everything for granted, basically, what we have. We should also be happy about, okay, look, like other people grew up in wars and extreme bad conditions to live and no water and all of this stuff. So from this point of view, if you don't live in Flint, Michigan, you're basically not so bad. That's not so bad off, with at least with the water supply everywhere.
Have you ever been approached by, let's say, Amazon or Netflix to buy your whole library?
No. It's like we work as world sales agents. We do package deals from time to time with a lot of movies going to one source. But it so far didn't happen. It's too bad, but I would be good, you know. Very early in the beginning, because there was a guy from Universal being one of the chefs at Hulu. What is it? Hulu, no?
Yeah, Hulu.
Yeah. And he said he wants to make like an Uber ball button.
Yeah.
On Hulu. And I said, let's do this. And then I think 6 months later, he was fired and never followed up. But it would be cool because I made over 30 movies and I produced another 20-30 movies like Zombie Massacre, this kind of movies. We could put all under the Uber Ball button, and under the button, I could do also messages or talking like making offs about movies, like stuff like this, director commentary. So it would be great if somebody would put this up as a service and would say, look, that is a great idea, you know. So I would also have, I would have the chance to generate revenues with it. And with more revenues coming in for the old movies, I could plan another new movie.
That would be great. I'm sure fans like myself out there would like you to make another film. I know we discussed this before, but I have to ask. I think our listeners would find it fascinating. Who do you want to work with that you've never worked with?
Yeah, I mean, I heard, like, I mean, you want to work, of course, with people that have good reputation to be team players and to be nice. And there was the thing with Christian Slater. He played in Alone in the Dark, and he told me, like, when he shot this 3,000 Miles to Graceland movie, and he said Kevin Costner was just a total asshole. And he and Kurt Russell were always, when the director said, let's shoot, right? So they always waited 5 to 10 minutes before Kevin Costner came out of his trailer, walking slowly to the set. And Kurt Russell and Slater were on time, they were on their marks, they were ready to do the scene, and nobody ever came. And my producer, Dan Clark, he worked as assistant for Clint Eastwood. He made 20 of my movies, Dan Clark. And so when he did Perfect World, he had the same experience with, so Kevin Costner didn't came out of the trailer, didn't did anything. But Clint Eastwood didn't took it, right? So he said, like, if you're not on your mark when I say you shoot, we're shooting now, I shoot without you. I just cut you out of the scene and have, like, the boy alone with the woman or whatever, right? So, and I said, like, I give a fuck. Like, when I say we're shooting, you get out and we shoot. And then Costner came out on time because Eastwood was actually shooting a few scenes without Costner. And and that is the thing. It's like, what I don't like is when people have this star allures and, like, they treat the little ones like shit, you know, and then they pussy out. But Clint Eastwood, he pussied out. 3,000 Miles to Graceland, I don't know who's the director, but whatever, like an unknown director. And then Costner gave a shit about the director, and whatever the director said, Costner didn't. Did it, right? So, and that is the worst behavior, I think. So I always treated everybody on set the same, from the hairdresser to the star, you know.
Director of 3,000 Miles to Graceland is Damien Lichtenstein.
Yeah, see, now you know why he didn't came out.
I've never heard of him.
No, but that is the problem with a lot of the situations, right? So, and by the way, that is another thing also where I hope for that Hollywood at one point comes and gives me a movie to direct. I mean, I made all my movies on time in budget.
Yeah, I'm sure you did.
Yeah, you know, so, and I would be the perfect player for a studio to bring something in on time in budget. And I remember when we shot Alone in the Dark in the Vancouver Film Studios, like one hall away from us was X-Men. With Halle Berry, and every day, Singer, like Brian Singer, he left like at lunch and never came back. And then Halle Berry was flipping out. And we had a lot of people from X-Men on our set hanging out, you know, at craft service drinking coffee, and we were always asking, like, why are you guys not shooting? Yeah, because the director left and whatever. And as an example, like Brian Singer. Everybody knew that here in Vancouver that he is like kind of a pedophile, right? So that he actually goes after young boys. Everybody knows it, but nobody came out with it for years and years and years, because they all saw he's untouchable, a superstar director whatsoever. But forget all of this. On the other hand, he never came in budget. He always went over budget because he took drugs, like delays, whatever, right? So why he got so many jobs? Because his agents, managers were strongly on him. You know, they got him hyped up, and the whole this kind of like wave, what we have now with the Me Too moment, right? That didn't exist at that point. And so people got away, basically, with murder. Kevin Spacey, everybody knows what he was doing, you know? So, and nothing happened. Harvey Weinstein, of course the people know it. The actors knew it. The actress, like whatever, from Scarlett Johansson, Nicole Kidman, they all know it, and they all, a lot of them, fucked him, right? So, I mean, that's the reality. And then, at one point, when and the Weinstein Company were not a big player anymore. They got replaced by Netflix, Amazon, whatever. They got they were not good in financial shape. They didn't have a lot of hit movies anymore. And boom, then they all went after him. But 10 years ago, everybody was kissing that guy's ass, and everybody knew it at that point already, especially the woman. Don't forget, Selma Hayek, whatever, they are not unknown people who say, hey, now he, whatever, masturbated in front of them. You know, like, that is the thing. It's like, but why they didn't came out earlier? What was holding them back? Why Nicole Kidman, Scarlett Johansson, etc., exactly, were holding back? Because for them, their career, their money was more important as calling out a rapist. So, and that is the thing. And I never played that game. I never was like this kind of kissing anybody's ass. That was also, in my case, extremely in my disadvantage in Hollywood. You know, but if there would be like more real producers out there, they would see that they would have in me the perfect director who they can trust, who actually most of the actors really like to work with me, who would say whatever, like, you do that movie, it's whatever $40 million budget, do it. You know, so, and that is the thing, but that also didn't happen. For this, I was too much of an outsider. And then you see the Raspberry Awards, whatever, you know, like, also they tried to trash me in all that years. And for no real reason, to be honest. You know, like, when I got that Raspberry, that was the year I delivered Postal and Tunnel Rats. And then I won the Golden Raspberry for the worst life work, right? If they would watch Tunnel Rats or Postal and say they were bad movies, they're out of their mind.
Okay, last question, because I always have to ask you this, and we discussed it last time, but I thought it was very funny. German beer or Canadian beer?
Of course, German beer. It's clean, brewed from like Hopfen and Malz, we say in Germany, right? So you cannot mix other things in. You can also not just mix random other flavors in. And in Vancouver, in my bars and restaurants, we have German beer on tap, like Krombacher Pilsener, dark and normal. And then we have Erdinger Weissbier. And you drink the Hacker, sure, they're very good too. And I'm not the biggest fan of that craft beers or beer mixes. I don't want to drink a beer and feel only smoke or whiskey or leather or chocolate or raspberries. I want a beer has to taste like a beer. You know, so that is what I like. And good that a few people like it too. And I feel always sorry for people that drink Bud Light in movies because they're getting paid for it. So it's horrible. And the interesting thing is that the original Budweiser is very good from Czech Republic, right? So the original one is also like has more alcohol. And in Europe, you get a lot but from the tap, like from the keg in a lot of bars, also in Germany, and it's very good actually. But the U.S. version is it's horrible.
So before you go, I just want to ask one last question. Are all your films still available to buy somewhere, or do they order them from you? So Amazon carries all your products?
Yes, I think on Netflix right now is only Rampage 3. And I think on iTunes are various Bond movies to buy. And then but mostly DVDs and Blu-rays on Amazon are available. That is the best way to acquire them. And when everybody says, oh, you don't need DVDs anymore, I think it's actually funny because my hard drive here broke 3 times and I lost everything what I taped on my hard drive like in the last 5 years, you know. And then they come, like the Thales here on my TV provider, they come and they exchange the hard drive for free, but they didn't save it. And 100 times I said, why you don't have a cloud? Like, I don't want like to lose everything what I tape here from HBO, Movie Central, whatever I have, right? So I want to be able to store it because it's only like whatever 3 months online, then it's gone. And you know, so and was sort of, yeah, but all gone. And I was so pissed various times about things. I had all Breaking Bad, all episodes, all gone. And then you feel like now going back to the DVDs because you put them in your, on your shelf and they're actually there. So I think that they gave up the DVDs too early on the planet Earth. Yeah.
Well, again, thank you for coming back and doing this a second.
Hey, thank you for listening. Could you please give us an iTunes review? And also, if you'd like to donate, please do so at our homepage.